I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Lineker. Stephen is a clinical psychologist supporting those with neurodevelopmental disorders in Doncaster CAMHS. He has previous experience of working with both children and adults with eating disorders, including those with ARFID. Stephen is also the chair of a local charity in Nottingham called Freed Beaches, which is providing support for families and people with ARFID. In this week's episode, we speak all about Stephen's experience of having an eating disorder and how conditions like type 1 diabetes and cerebral palsy played into this. We also speak about Stephen's experience of supporting those with ARFID and his advice for clinicians who are doing the same. I really hope you enjoy this insightful episode. Well, Stephen, it is so nice to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Did you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, my name's Dr. Stephen Lineker. I'm a clinical psychologist. I currently work in a neurodevelopmental service, but I have quite a lot of experience with eating disorders and working with people with ARFID. And also, in the past, I've also experienced my own eating disorder, which I do freely share.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. Can I ask, when you say neurodevelopmental disorders, what does that cover in terms of what you support people with?
Well, the term is disorder, but obviously it's different. It's looking at people that experience autism and ADHD. So I tend to work a lot with schools, with parents, with groups that people go to, but obviously, as a psychologist, you want to look at things holistically. Often I do provide links and support for parents, carers, and the people that I see. But historically, I've worked with adults in eating disorder service and also with children in eating disorder services.
Yeah, amazing. And what was it that led you to specialise in eating disorders?
Well, originally, when I was young, I knew that I had difficulties with eating, difficulties with weight and shape, and that unfortunately did lead me to get very unwell. But also what I wanted to try and support was parents and carers, because I'd seen how difficult it had been for my parents. And when I got better, I wanted to find a career that hopefully could make a difference, hopefully could support parents and carers to understand eating disorders better, to help them to navigate all the difficulties that a young person or an adult can have. And I think also the positive things that I had through the things that got me ill have actually helped me to turn that on its head. And sometimes I think the sort of the characteristics of being perfectionistic or being tenacious with things can sometimes cause difficulties, but at the same time it has also helped me get to where I am today. So if anybody ever said to me, do you wish you never had an eating disorder, obviously the answer for me now is no, but at the time it was obviously definitely yes. I think coming out on the other side of it has been something that has helped shape my life and also shaped my career choices.
Yeah, and I think that's amazing. In a similar respect to you, I don't work within the medical sector, but my own experience has shaped my passion to want to help others. And I think that if you, as long as you're looking after yourself first, and then you go on to support people. I think it can be amazing because you have an insight into what it's like to live with an eating disorder that you can't really learn from a textbook. So amazing that you have been able to use your own experience. And it's really funny what you said about the characteristics that you have that maybe made you susceptible to an eating disorder, because I was literally having that conversation with my mum yesterday about, we were talking about imposter syndrome, and she said, well, is there anything good about imposter syndrome? And I said, well, it's like every characteristic, isn't it? Too much of anything is bad. And, you know, sometimes, like you said, perfectionism, rigidity, you know, being very dedicated, being very motivated, they can be really good, but too much of them, they can take over, or if you've got the wrong focus. But actually, that's been a big part of my recovery, is being like, okay, I have these traits, and maybe they meant that I was susceptible to an eating disorder, which wasn't the best thing to focus on, but what can I refocus on now that means I can use those traits, but for them to be really supportive rather than being negative in my life?
Definitely. I mean, I totally agree with the imposter syndrome thing. And people say, oh, well, you must be doing really well. You've been 14 years qualified. You've written parts of a book. You've done research. You've got research articles. But sometimes you still feel as though I'm still making all this up.
Yeah, someone's going to call me out as a fraud. Someone's going to realise.
But I mean, at the end of the day, I think what you do learn through going through it is you learn to understand yourself better. Yes, we've all got strengths and needs. It's important to recognize the needs that you have and try to help yourself and get other people to help you in those areas. I mean, for example, I also have mild cerebral palsy, so, and type 1 diabetes. So there's a complexity of different things that I have that I still have to manage. But I think when you understand what things help and what things don't help, you are in a better position to achieve what you want to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that when you're then able to be in a place where you can use your characteristics for the better, if there's other things going on, it gives you a better way of managing them as well. Because I can imagine, you know, if you've got an eating disorder and that's maybe not being most supportive to your life, it's then you've not got the capacity to navigate those other things, which I can imagine can be detrimental as well. Would you mind sharing a bit more about your own eating disorder experience?
Yeah, I mean, let's say it started around 13. I was, you know, I think at the time I experienced some bullying in my life, some trauma that occurred. And I think one of the things was to try and lose some weight. And I think I got into a pattern of eating very little food, but also over exercising. And those traits became quite obsessive. And then before you know it, you're stuck. And it did require several admissions to hospital with the support I had with the specialist eating disorder service, the ongoing therapy. That did help me to start to look at things in a different way. When you say, are you recovered from an eating disorder? I do say I am now, but for a long time, it was that sort of, well, I'm not sure. I think it's took a good, 20 years to sort of say, yes, I'm fully recovered. I think there has been times where it's very easy to fall back into those traps. But I think also the diabetes, the type 1 diabetes that came on during the time I had anorexia also made it very complicated. Even today, I have to think about food. I have to think about, well, have I got the right insulin? Have I got the right carbohydrate? It was a very difficult thing to separate one from the other. I mean, we know for research, for example, that there are higher levels of eating disorders with people that may have had difficulties at birth. And obviously, it's a nature nurture thing. There's aspects of both your genetics, but also aspects of your environmental experiences that may develop into an eating disorder. For a man with an eating disorder, what we're talking 25, 26 years ago now, they didn't know how to manage it. I think there's a lot less judgment on to say that there is still stigma, but I do think we are moving in the right direction, but it's a very, very slow process.
I've got so many questions to ask you from what you said already. So going right back to what you were saying about your experience, You mentioned the type 1 diabetes, and I mean, I've spoken to people on the podcast before that have been diagnosed with TIDE, and they have said that having an eating disorder and having type 1 diabetes, treatment for type 1 diabetes, this is their words, was basically the advice to give you an eating disorder. People always say recovery from an eating disorder is really difficult because you have to eat. You can't abstain from them. But I can imagine with type 1 diabetes, it's an additional level because you have to, as you've described, keep track of your blood sugars, your carbohydrates. You have to be so careful about how you eat. So naturally, I can imagine that's so fear-mongering. Did you experience TIDE as well?
I never got to the point where I was injecting insulin to try and lose weight. I did get to the point where I had severe hyperglycemia, where because I wouldn't eat, it used to be called diabulimia, which was an awful name. They're still thinking some eating disorder services, they need more training in it because they need to recognize that is extremely complex and also sometimes contradictory to what then the diabetes service is saying. I think that's why it's important that they work together.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important thing. So there's so many people that have multiple comorbidities or conditions and they need to be supported alongside each other. And something else that you mentioned that I just wanted to pick up on is you said that there's research showing about higher rates of eating disorders in people that had difficulties at birth. And I hadn't heard about that. I wondered if you would maybe want to expand on the research.
There is evidence to show that if you've had a difficult pregnancy or you've had a difficult birth specifically, there is a higher risk. I mean, they obviously work out risk and things, and obviously they've interviewed lots and lots of people with eating disorders to try and find trends. I think what they were saying is that there's a higher prevalence of people that may experience difficult births that then may go on to develop an eating disorder. Obviously in my case, cerebral palsy, it means that your brain is starved of oxygen when you're trying to get out. But anecdotally, I have seen people that have things like cerebral palsy and things then have difficulties with their mental health. For me, as on a personal level, for me, when I was growing up, I never felt adequate. So I never felt good enough. When you're then trying to be better, then that's where I suppose rituals and obsessiveness can come in.
I suppose on a very broad level there, it almost seems like the general consensus is quite similar in terms of not feeling like you fit in, not feeling worthy enough, and that the eating disorder then being this shiny thing that basically says, I'll make you feel enough, I'll make you fit in, like we can do all of these things together. The reality of that is obviously absolutely not true, but it kind of like holds that beacon of hope. And it sounds like it's kind of similar between the two there.
Yeah, definitely. It draws you into that false sense of security. Mm-hmm. It draws you into making you feel a bit better and giving you that confidence initially anyway. It's one of those things, as we know, with particularly with anorexia or bulimia, that it can be something whereby initially it gives you that improving self-esteem, but very quickly then takes it away.
I always think it's like dangling a carrot. I think a lot of people talk about their experience of anorexia when you start to initially lose weight. There'll be comments from people saying how great you look now you've lost weight, but then as much as that feels great, it then very rapidly becomes something that you can't break away from. And then your social life is ruined, your work life is ruined, your relationships are ruined. You have no sense of self because you just feel like you're an eating disorder now. And I always think it's like it dangles the carrot to be like, yeah, but if you just do a little bit more, you can get that feeling again, which then keeps you in that cycle.
And it's the same with the exercise as well. I mean, when I was a lot younger, social media was only just starting and things, so didn't even have that. But obviously it was all over the telly, you know, try to be fitter, try to eat better. But unfortunately, with people that may have that low self-esteem, it was then something that then just developed and grew bigger and grew bigger. and became an obsessiveness.
I think that's so many people's experience. You get involved in it not really knowing what you're getting involved in, and then after a very short amount of time, you feel trapped and there's no other option. I know you also wanted to speak about ARFID because that's where your specialty lies. So what has been your experience of supporting people with ARFID?
So it's been limited because of services generally. I have tried to develop pathways in the NHS to try and support services, but at the moment the funding is very limited. Partly that's due to the limited amount of research at the highest level. So we're calling it randomised controlled trials, RCTs, and it's very difficult then to say, well, you know, this is the way we should treat ARFID, or this is the service that should treat ARFID. And also some eating disorder services are not commissioned for ARFID. So there's a whole political debate about what services should look like, what services should deal with what. And I think basically what we should try to deal with is, obviously, it's an eating disorder. So for me, ARFID should come under the eating disorder umbrella, but there sometimes needs to be other specialisms involved with. So when I was in an eating disorder service, we did have some ARFID cases that came up. And I think basically what tends to happen is they come through as an anorexia case, but then once you've started to do your assessment, you start to realise that actually any anorexia treatment could and would potentially be more harmful, because it's not anorexia. They may have lost weight, they may have, and just that as a caveat, just to say you can have ARFID and not be low weight, just like anorexia can be there and not low weight. But I do think sometimes people are put down the path of, let's say, FTAN, which is family therapy anorexia, or other approaches for anorexia, but they're not necessarily the right ones for that person.
Why could that be detrimental?
For example, if we talk about the FTAN, we are looking at ways to sort of support the family to increase the intake. And because ARFID is, if we are not addressing the three main criteria that ARFID potentially could be, right, and just looking at issues that they may come up with regards weight and shape, or, you know, then that can be totally missed. And because somebody with ARFID can still have concerns, just like any teenager or young person or adult can have concerns about their body image, but it's not necessarily the main driver in your assessment. Consider the person as a whole, not just go off what may have come in the referral.
What would be some kind of things to look out for to kind of make that decision?
I suppose when you've got a client that comes into your service and they've lost a lot of weight, we know that from research that shows that the brain structure changes when you've lost weight. So they can be quite a lot of features that may look like anorexia. But it's important to ask questions around worries about the consequences of eating, not just gaining weight. So there might be, for example, worries that they may have toileting issues, or they may be worrying about reflux or about being sick. The same thing around sort of sensory issues and eating. So it might be that, for example, they can't eat certain coloured foods, or they might not be able to eat certain brands. And sometimes that is also linked into anorexia, because they want the lowest calories. But it's understanding the function of the behaviour, understanding what the person's motivations are. One of the criteria is just not having an interest in food or eating. And that might be due to things like poor interoception, which is basically your ability to know your insides and what's going off in your body. So some people might just say, well, I'm never hungry. And if they say that, it's important to follow that question up with, you know, how long has that been in place? And also, what sensations is fullness? So asking about the sensory aspects. And again, sometimes clients may not be able to answer these questions, but I would certainly advise that, you know, they look at things like from the PEACE pathway, which is mainly for autism and eating disorders. But also it does help with thinking about sensory experiences with eating. And then also Rachel Bryant Wall's website down at the Maudsley has also got some screening questionnaires for possible ARFID that can be used for clinicians. But I think it's important that they remain open and not just think the weight loss is due to weight shape issues.
You've also mentioned neurodiversity and autism a bit. Is autism something that always presents when somebody has ARFID, or is it something that's common to present?
It's fairly common. However, you don't have to have autism or ADHD to have ARFID. There was some research recently, and obviously bear in mind that they only did a certain amount of people that they reviewed, I think of thousands of people that they reviewed, of people with autism also had ARFID. The other way round, it was 11.41% of people that had ARFID also would meet diagnosis of autism. But what you've got to bear in mind with this is obviously it's one clinical study, and you know, I think there can always be an element of, well, you know, if people are finding it very difficult to get diagnosed with autism at the moment, they also find it very difficult to get diagnosed with ARFID because services are not necessarily putting the diagnostic label on. But I also think there is an element of, well, you may have an autistic rule around food, so like brands, but it may not be at that significant level that would then meet the diagnostic criteria for ARFID. So it's important that when people say, oh, well, I have got ARFID traits, it's not necessarily at the level that would be diagnosed.
I always think as well, if somebody is potentially, you know, struggling to manage with their autism already, they are probably more likely to go to the doctors and ask for a diagnosis, and then potentially the ARFID could be picked up because a professional is like, also, you know, you're struggling with your food and you've got a limited variety of food and the fear of consequences and things like that. But if somebody's, let's say, neurotypical and they struggle with those issues, you know, people around them may just think, oh, they might get labelled a fussy eater, which yes. You and I both know that there's a big difference between fussy eating and ARFID, but I think somebody may not go to the doctor to try and think about a diagnosis if they're not already getting support for something else.
I agree. I think basically, like you said, usually people with autism are already being seen by professionals, hopefully. And like you say, there is a big crossover in terms of, you know, an autistic rule, let's say, about eating, which potentially, if you are in a way where you don't like change, where you don't like sort of particular foods because of textures and things, there is then a likelihood it could develop that far. However, we haven't got to assume that. I think in terms of people that aren't neurodiverse and they have difficulties with their eating, but they've got no problems with their weight and shape, then often, like you say, they may try to dismiss it or not seek the support. It's important that it's recognised that if it's affecting their life significantly, or it's making them miserable, or it's causing relational difficulties, and there is support.
Yeah, absolutely. And just in terms of support, I know you mentioned parents and carers, and I think that, you know, obviously ARFID can impact anybody of any age, and I think that whoever is struggling, whose loved ones around them, I think it can be a very distressing thing to support somebody with and experience. Additionally, on top of that, I think there's a lot of stigma around ARFID that can make it even more challenging to support someone through. What would be your best advice for those that are supporting somebody with ARFID?
Well, if the person with ARFID was an adult, The first thing I think parents and carers should do is just listen. You know, I think we all assume things, or, you know, she should be able to do that. It's about ensuring that the relationship doesn't get to the point where there's what we call I expressed emotion. So I think, I mean, in anorexia and other eating disorders, we know things that parents and carers can fall into the trap of, things like accommodating and labeling behaviours. Similarly, to a certain extent, if we're not careful, we can assume as a parent or carer that we think we know best for this person. And there might be a lot of anxiety around what they are or what they're not eating. But this is where I suppose sometimes people do need support from dietitians. To me, it's about support as a parent or carer, supporting awareness in a non-critical way. So it's very difficult to do, because you might just come out with, oh, you're not eating again, or, you know, and obviously tone of voice and things like that can be misconstrued. I think it's about having that initial conversation and not trying to push the person into a point. If they don't see there's a problem, they're not going to change it. Sometimes it will get worse when there's higher stressors, and then they won't be able to get back to that food again. They have got to be able to see that there's a problem themselves, particularly in the adult population. And maybe it's about sort of, you know, some of the techniques that Janet Treasure did around sort of like the readiness ruler and things like that can be quite useful. But if you've identified you know what you're eating at the minute on a scale of 0 to 10, how as important is it for you to change what you're eating at the minute? And how confident do you feel you can change what you eat at the minute? So some of the tools that have been for parents and carers for the anorexia and the other eating disorders can also be very useful in starting those conversations up. I do think, obviously, if you are noticing, or if the person with the ARFID is noticing changes in how they're feeling, it is important that, whether or not they've lost weight or not, it is important that they seek medical support, go to the GP. Because what we have sadly seen is sometimes there is mineral and vitamin deficiencies due to the person only eating one particular food, or situations like that. And again, obviously, when people are resistant to that, it's difficult as a parent and carer. In the child sort of world that I work in, often parents are very anxious. The child may only be eating 3 or 4 different foods, and that's all they'll have, and then there's arguments, etc. But usually when we've liaised with the dietitian and things, you know, as long as we keep those as the safe food, we can build on that. And the food that they are having is sustainable and is still helping them to grow. So this is where I suppose the social element of the food can be obviously a big thing, particularly if you're an adult with ARFID. Would they like to be able to go out with their friends to a restaurant? You know, is this stopping some aspect in their life that they would like to do? And I suppose if the answer is yes, then you want to be able to seek some support with that. It's just about the impact that it has with other things in your life. Would you be able to go to a restaurant? Yeah. Could you be able to build a relationship? Could you meet with your friends? It's those kind of things to think about.
I think that's always the thing that I've thought in terms of treatment. And I think the same with any eating disorder is that ultimately, and you, that was a question I wanted to ask you earlier, and then got carried away in the conversation, but you know, you said that you were fully recovered, and I always think, you know, that's such a unique thing for somebody. Your fully recovered could be very different to my fully recovered, and actually I think that's so important when you're in recovery, is to think about, what do I want my life to look like? You know, if I want to be able to go out to a social event, to any restaurant, and be able to order something off the menu, there's probably work that I need to do here. But also, some people might not want that, and if people are genuinely happy, and I think that that's the really important thing, is to think, are you happy because the eating disorder is satisfied, or are you happy because you are genuinely happy with the food that you eat and the life that you lead? Then I think that's the most important thing to understand in recovery, rather than having this clear set, you must eat these food groups and you must, you know, meet this criteria or what have you, because ultimately, you know, we're all different. We've all got our own likes and dislikes. But I think not having that restriction, whether it's calorie restriction or food group restriction, that's then restricting your life, that's what we're trying to achieve in recovery.
Of course, you know, it's about listening to the person. It's about understanding what their wishes and desires are. So it is about an individual person's level of what they feel as though they're recovered with. But like I say, for me, I couldn't say that for a long time with the eating disorder. And it is an individual person's view. And I think you have to be fully confident in yourself and your ability to manage the stresses of eating to be able to say that. But at the same time, other people may say it and be happy to say it, but it only you as a person knows you. You can see as many psychologists or as many professionals as you want, even those that have had their own experience. But at the end of the day, the person is the person, and they have their experience, views of the world, and understanding of themselves. And that's the bit that I think whatever we try to do in any therapy or any assessments or whatever, is to try and help the people understand themselves better. And then they then have to make the choices.
And I think develop that level of trust and honesty with yourself, because as you said, you know, you can go to as many psychologists as you want, but if you're not honest with yourself about how you feel about your behaviours, or, you know, the thoughts that are happening, or, you know, oh, I'm fine with having, you know, a teeny tiny breakfast and I'm fine to do that for the rest of my life, or I'm fine not to go travelling and explore the world and eat different foods. But are you really fine with that? Or is it the safety of your eating disorder that I totally resonate and understand why it can feel safe to be there? But I do think that unless you have that honesty with yourself, recovery you can't fully engage in. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for chatting to me. The time has absolutely flown, and it's been honestly such a pleasure to chat to you, and I think the insights that you've brought have been so, so helpful for people. Where can people go to find out more about you or get in contact?
Well, I mean, obviously one of the things we wanted to mention was about Freed Beaches. That's the charity that I am a chair of the trustees board, and that is something that we are trying to promote. It's a very difficult time for charities, but we are trying to promote support for eating disorders, and we do offer support for people with ARFID. Currently it's only for the area of Nottinghamshire, but we are obviously wanting to expand that and also do potentially online sessions and things like that.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. It's honestly been such a pleasure to chat to you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.